This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Michael Beckley, Chief Technology Officer and Founder of Appian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I started Appian with my friends 20 years ago. We're now a global public company and considered a leader in the low-code automation market. I grew up in the Midwest of the United States, but came out to the East Coast after school. I went to work for a small business intelligence startup, which is now also a global public company, not due to my personal initiative, but it was certainly the best graduate school education I could have ever hoped for. Spent 3 years at that firm, and after that IPO, we branched out, started Appian, and 20 years later, here we are.
Before the podcast started, you and I were just talking about Ataris and Apples, 6502 assembler, 68000 assembler, and that's where many of us thought coding was back in the day. Now, we're into a low-code, no-code world where all of those complex processes that we try to get our heads around are just given to people. It's made much simpler for them to code. How did we get from there to here?
It's interesting because I came to the problem of coding from the standpoint of basic programming language. That was what my first introduction when I was 6, and then moved into object-oriented and ultimately down the chain to assembler from the top. My use of coding was typically involved in my family business. My father had a small law firm, and we used a software to gain competitive advantage and compete directly with the largest law firms in the country. When we were litigating in cases against Skadden, Arps, and Sherman & Sterling, the biggest and best, we had this secret advantage, which was essentially low code for the era. We were able to crank out applications and manage discovery for huge projects. To me, coding was best when it was practical, when it was effective, and it was something that you could do without actually having to know the details of the chip. When it came to assembler and going through all the manuals and trying to figure out in your own code where you had messed up one of your hex codes, I found it incredibly frustrating. Those are the areas where I'd prefer to use some commercial package where they had spent years developing that expertise and had a quality assurance pipeline that I could rely on.
If we look at how coding has evolved over the last 40 years, it's no longer about development teams. A large amount of code is being produced by users and has been ever since we have macro languages. A lot of your competitors position their products very much at that end of the market, starting from the hobbyist through to the person in the office who would write a macro to speed something up. And even RPA now focuses on what individuals want to actually do to speed their job up. Where do we actually sit effectively as a low-code environment? Is it with that end-user group, or is it in speeding up the pressure on software?
Appian rejects the notion that people should be compartmentalized into these discrete roles. That, to us, is basically hearkening back to the days of waterfall methodology, where you either had business analysts who were in their lane drawing Visio diagrams and trying to write user stories, and you had developers who were the high priests who managed the code. And then that loss in translation between the two was always problematic. When these new upstart products talk about no code, they're talking about giving basically Microsoft Office users a better way to route documents amongst a small team with some approval workflow, maybe even exposing it through a web app, but without any of the governance that it takes to actually manage that brand's reputation. So we say low-code automation should be about putting business and IT on the same shared model of the business and giving them both the tools to do their job effectively and more productively. Appian is a true enterprise solution, so that means we do have elements of no-code and we have elements of low-code, and we still have the eject mechanism when you absolutely need high code to interact with some legacy enterprise system. And it's that full stack automation and that shared model of the business and that enterprise perspective where we don't expect to have all the data resident in Appian. That's, I would call, maybe a more modest approach to enterprise engineering and not assuming that Appian is the complete answer. But it's why I think we're so effective right now at solving problems that other technologies have failed at.
But let's take a step backwards for a minute. A lot of my time is spent around cybersecurity. One of our biggest problems is not just new code that is insecure because it isn't thought through or built properly, but it's that vast hereditary set of code that's out there. A lot of that could be solved if people understood what they had as a software asset. If we think about those artificial boundaries of stuff written inside a software department, we struggled to properly manage our assets there. Once we moved to the full company, everybody's a software developer world, how do we begin to know what software assets we have? How do we begin to secure those software assets? How do we, in effect, remove our cybersecurity problem?
You're never going to eliminate it, but by using a low-code automation platform, you at least reduce your attack surface significantly if you use it properly. With Appian, we approach low-code automation from the notion of a shared platform that's governed by IT. Instead of creating little silos where the apps are themselves generated code that can go live and run in isolation and become those lost assets, they're all running in our runtime, and so therefore governed by IT and managed by IT. The applications themselves are self-documenting for auditability, traceability, and transparency. Ultimately, IT can easily search across all the different assets, not only the applications themselves, but the reusable objects that may be shared between applications. Instead of just defining security at, say, some sort of front-end layer, you're defining security integral to the way users and groups are sharing that data, such that it's very difficult to mess up. In fact, there are security guardrails built into the platform so that every time you deploy an application to production, before you do, we're authenticating that you have mapped security permissions the way you intended, and in security best practices have been applied. Part of that is for security reasons. Part of that is just for developer productivity. And the most common problem we've seen historically is that people will publish apps with objects that no one has visibility to them. And so you're wondering why you just spent all day working on something in this form and you can't see the form. And it's just because you missed that one object out of hundreds. And so having a platform approach gives us the ability to provide actual better tools so that you can look at your security holistically, you can audit it, you can see all your assets, and ultimately leave IT in control, even though you're delegating creation capabilities to the business.
One of the benefits that DevOps has brought us is the ease with which we can now move software from A to B. We can start with an idea, we can have it in production, but because we're working on short cycles, we've reduced the size of what we're trying to write, and everybody's engaged, we've had a massive improvement in productivity. Part of the gain to that productivity has been the use of pipelines. Security is finally starting to understand developers. It's starting to understand in a DevOps world, it can be part of that pipeline. When we look at the platform, how do you bring that DevOps pipeline? More importantly, how do you bring that security team with their pipelines to add better testing and quality control into that process rather than, as you said, trying to front-end something with a security process?
We talk about DevSecOps, and that's development and operations being unified and now security being a part of every step there. Appian, what we do is, again, we're trying to give you everything you need in the box, but we also want to be a good enterprise citizen and live with whatever pipeline you may have already created. When you use Appian, we actually automatically provision for you, at a minimum, a dev test and staging environment in the cloud. You can also run us on-prem and use your own pipeline or use our development DevOps tools. If you're using our tooling, all those environments are automatically connectable. And so now a developer can see the operations usage data for their objects, for their apps, even though they wouldn't have direct permissions to change them because that's a production environment. And so now the question is about the security. How do we avoid an abstraction layer actually hiding and obscuring security issues? The key there is DevSecOps is to move testing to the left, closer to the development process so that we find issues early. With Appian, that begins again with the platform approach. We enforce a model view controller model in our component-based architecture. Now, instead of having business logic intermingled with how your apps are going to actually render, whether it's on the web or mobile, that's a forced isolation and separation. The components, when you use Appian components to build your applications, those are pre-built and pre-hardened by us. And so you can customize them only to the extent that you're configuring them. So there's no custom JavaScript, no HTML, CSS, no SQL injection attacks, no cross-site request forgery that can be injected by your least experienced developer or your outside contractor or your malicious employee. It's just not possible through the component framework. So what we've effectively done is moved a whole set of UI testing all the way up to the platform ownership that's us. And again, we take a model of shared responsibility here in the sense of it's still your app and you should pen test it. We encourage our clients to do that. We work with them to do that. But now, if someone finds a mistake, and we're not perfect, but when someone in the entire user community finds that mistake through a pen test or through some other test, what happens is we fix the platform, probably in 24, 48 hours, and now every environment, whether it's dev, test, staging, pre-prod, prod, are patched simultaneously, effectively. So you don't have this lingering asset out there that is behind on patching, behind in updated, not properly tested, not equivalently tested, and therefore providing a backdoor into the environment. So that's one example of how the platform works with DevSecOps, but it's just one. And we could talk about every element of the SDLC to show how we can do more. At the end of the day, with a low-code platform, there's still no reason why you can't take that package, that runtime from Appian, and put it into your own pipeline and run your own tests against it.
I'd like to come back to part of that issue of patching in a minute. But before that, something you said there really got my attention. You talked about doing it all in the platform, having it in the platform where it should be. Talking to the CubeSec teams over the last 18 months, 2 years, it's become evident that they see that ultimate shift left as actually having the base security elements in the underlying frameworks that everybody uses. However, when I talk to enterprise development organizations, I get a lot of shaking of heads and a lot of, oh, it sounds nice, but it'll never work. You seem to be much more on, let's get those elements in the framework so they're invisible, but they actually exist. How easy is that for a lot of organizations to change how they've done development over the years and bring security that far left? Or is it going to be part of an eventual journey?
Oh, it's definitely a journey, but many organizations that we work with are already doing it. You take a look at, in the UK, the biggest insurer, Aviva, is a huge Appian customer. They have made tremendous strides in the way they're able to deliver to their business audiences much faster. And then the end result, of course, is Aviva's whole mission is to make sure that their clients are satisfied. And so to be able to go from being able to close out a fund in not 9 days, but in 1 day, and to transfer funds from not in 45 minutes, but in 5 minutes, that's because they're taking 22 different disparate systems and unifying them in Appian into one view for the customer service agent. That doesn't mean that that one application doesn't need to be rigorously tested. And it doesn't mean that it's 100% in Appian. But it does mean that every time they're able to leverage the platform, they're able to reduce the attack surface that their traditional methodologies and traditional testing has to rigorously look at.
But part of that reduction of attack surface means also dealing with compliance. Much of the code that we write these days affects PII. But understanding what we're doing with it, making sure we handle it correctly, is not a simple matter, not least because the laws behind it are incredibly complicated and change from region to region. How do we allow the platform to integrate, for want of a better word, with our compliance solutions, such that when there's a set of rules on the handling of certain classes of data, the platform understands this and actually helps the developer by enforcing controls?
Well, I think you pretty much just described it right there. This is exactly what the platform's job is, to not only help developers and give them guardrails and solve problems for them so that they don't have to think about those things. And the best way a platform can do that is by, of course, being built for the most rigorous regulatory standards, which Appian is. And then, as well, considering that the regulator is another customer of the platform, another user of the platform. And so providing tooling in our applications that make it easy for a regulator to look at an audit, to see how a bot was programmed, to see who approved the programming of the bot, to therefore be able to back into why did this bot reject this application or allow it. That's what Appian allows you to do for a complete digital workforce and human workforce together. And that's really the thing that's new here, is that with full stack automation in Appian, you find one place where a regulator can go look at the human workers orchestrating, the digital workers orchestrating, artificial intelligence algorithms and direct integrations and business rules that have always been a part of, say, an expert system. So now it's all one thing, even though underneath the covers there may be AI technology from different public cloud providers. There may be your own inbuilt homegrown AI. You may have your bots from Blue Prism, from UiPath, or even Appian's own bots. And yet, for a regulator, it's one process that they can see and audit and inspect and drill into whatever detail they care about.
When you and I started coding, we borrow libraries from all sorts of places. Some of them written by user groups, some of them written by friends. Much of that's become open source these days. Some of it from commercial entities. Some of it even from the big software vendors who were just growing at the time. Today it tends to be two primary sources, the software vendors or open source. But one of the challenges of bringing in libraries is often we only use maybe one or two parts of a library. And these libraries can be huge. When those one or two parts are patched, we don't know whether we've actually used them in our organization because our bill of materials, the way we handle our assets, is often quite poor. How can we improve that from a platform perspective to provide us with a highly accurate view on bill of materials so that when that library with, let's just say, 1,000 function calls appears and only two are dangerous, I can actually see if I use those tools, I can make a proper assessment as to whether I need to patch all these apps or patch none.
I can't solve that problem for all software developers. What I can do is say, when you use the Appian platform, we have done that, and we constantly have to do that. So we have a zero tolerance policy for CVEs. When we look at any library coming into the platform, it has to go through security architecture review by three of the longest tenured employees who've been here, our senior architects who've been with Appian for 15 years or more. They understand the Appian code in and out, and they then have to work with the development team to validate and understand exactly what's in that library, whether we're using that function or not. And then we have continuous monitoring in place as new CVEs are discovered for existing libraries that we immediately go in and test and remediate. That's all upfront security architecture. It's hard work. I wish there were better tools that made that easier. But the best thing you can do at this point is let us do it for you. And then recognize that when all said and done with each release of Appian, we still send it out for third-party validation from NCC Group. They will then go through that same process of attacking our code and looking at our security architecture. We get back their findings and learn from that and fix how we work with that library as we move on. And then we burn it in here at Appian, and we run all of Appian on our own platform and with over 100 applications, so everything from finance to sales and marketing. And so we get more experience in the real world and our own employees trying things out, trying to get creative. Ultimately, we also have red teams and outside groups that we pay to attack the platform and come with their own deep knowledge of some of these libraries. We also set up Appian with the HackerOne bug bounty program. To me, I was not sold on until we did it. It seemed to me with all these different checks and layers that there would be perhaps trivial findings only left. But in fact, of course, there's no limit to human creativity. And so we found it. We've paid out real money to these hackers for incredibly valuable findings from the white hat community. It's often the case that it's the interaction of the libraries that they're able to exploit when you realize that we're running the platform for you. We're taking responsibility for the Linux operating system, for the Tomcat app server, for the web server. It's an arms race we can't win, but it's one we can't afford to lose. Most companies can afford to do that at scale for their most important application, but they can't afford to do it for the hundreds of applications that they build and run to keep their systems running every day, not without using a platform to get the leverage of taking advantage of our community.
How hard was it to get to that state? Because if I look around the industry, one of the biggest challenges that the software business seems to struggle with is how to create a proper vulnerability reporting and response mechanism. This isn't just about a CVE and a 30-day or a 60-day or a zero-day announcement. It's just the basic ability to take a report from any source and actually respond and act on it immediately, not just stick it in a drawer.
People and organizations, I like to say, are the sum of their habits. They're in a lifetime of accumulation of a set of activities that define them by what they do, not what they say they do. With us, it doesn't feel difficult now because it's how we operate, but it's how we always operated. We made a decision 20 years ago to focus our low-code automation efforts on the high end of the market. We looked at the biggest companies, the biggest global organizations, biggest government agencies, public sector groups, and said, what do they need? That's why we built an open architecture. It's why we chose Java. It's why we took security so seriously from the start. Even then, we had a lot to learn. You know, one of my early clients was Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon. And you can be sure that I still have their books on secure coding practices in my office. And it was an education. It was humbling. I say over and over again, to be humbled teaches you that you can't trust heroics. You can't trust a single person. You can't trust a single process. It's a set of activities and habits you accumulate over time. And that has to be built into the organization's priorities.
We came into this talking about 6502, 68000 Assemble, and where we came from. If I look at my own bookshelves, I still have books there that were written in the 60s and 70s. Some of them are about artificial intelligence, which we're only now realizing because we've reached a point where the technology can match the theory. History can be a very damning thing for any industry. Do you think that from this industry, people actually look back at warnings that were there and look at what we were told would happen and address it, or are we an industry growing so fast, we're still firefighting everything new?
We certainly don't feel new at Appian. We've been doing low-code automation for 20 years. We were quite mindful of the history of 4GLs and the history of artificial intelligence. And I went to Dartmouth, where the term was coined, artificial intelligence, at the 1956 seminar they held there. In fact, the basic programming language was also invented out of Dartmouth, which got me into computing. We grew up with this history. We studied it carefully. And what we found was a whole set of reasons why visual programming languages and model-driven environments worked up to a point. And then because they were too locked into one proprietary infrastructure, one proprietary environment, that they would run out of steam. We just said, okay, well, how do we as a vendor learn those lessons and build them in? it became as simple as creating an open approach to data from the start, not assuming that we could get away with having one proprietary data structure and it would somehow not be obsoleted in 5 years or 10 years. As well, when you define a process in Appian, from the start we realized model-driven environments had limitations in how much a human could understand, so we needed to allow for sub-processes and swim lanes and ways of breaking down a visual model into comprehensible pieces. We came up with a whole set of other decisions that allow us to constantly renew the environment and keep it current and modern and portable to different computing architectures. It's why we're not just in the cloud. It's why we're not locked into one architecture. And it's why I think after 20 years, we lead this market. And even though there are a lot of startups that will make news every few years by quickly binding themselves tightly coupled to one type of architecture, that can be very productive in a niche. It's not going to be a sustainable advantage for any organization to adopt it.
Taking all that into account, if I was to ask you to name three technologies that you either want in Appian or, looking back, you wish you'd added to Appian maybe earlier, what are they?
For all these things, you want the brochure, but being a veteran in the industry, you also know the dangers and risks of passing on those early learnings and rough edges of beta software to your customer base, let alone to your own support teams. Of course, the brochure at Kubernetes is fantastic, and we use it internally already, and we'll be using it to orchestrate customer workloads later this year. But I would have loved to have that capability built into the platform years ago when we first saw Kubernetes come out of the lab. It wasn't like we didn't already have that requirement. We were already running customer workloads and orchestrating them across multiple data centers and having to keep them up 24/7. And you can be sure having to rewrite that kind of high availability logic and code for every new module we wrote was incredibly tedious and taxing. To be able to offload that to the most popular open source project in the world, definitely exciting. I think you'd probably go through the similar sort of thinking for data. At the simple fundamental level, 20 years ago, we didn't just use relational databases. We incorporated NoSQL technology into Appian for the same reasons everyone does, for scalability, for performance, for agility with schema design. You think about what we do, we're trying to empower the business to launch new products, to improve customer experience by changing their service model, and that always changes the schema. And so a fixed relational schema alone was always problematic. And so we put in this middle tier with NoSQL technology. Every time there's a new database that's been created in the last 20 years, I always like to think, oh, I wish I had that. Wish I had that time series database. Oh, I wish I had that graph database. Oh, I wish. And here we are still actually taking the best ideas from the NoSQL database world and putting them into our NoSQL engine. Those are the two off top of the bat. React.js as well, fantastic rendering language. We wish we'd had incorporated it even sooner, but we did it now going on 4 years ago. It's paid tremendous dividends and makes the users obviously a lot happier, but it was also going through its own maturation phase. You want new tech early, but you also, at the enterprise, pay the price for pushing out new features too fast.
It's one of the fun things about this industry. Everything's new, but nothing's new.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I still have my grandfather's view graphs from IBM showing how they were solving business solutions with punch card machines. And it's the same business problems. How do you do order to cash? How do you align sales and marketing? You could take those presentations and give them today and just talk about Kubernetes and cloud, and people would understand exactly what you were talking about.
Michael, thank you for talking with me.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me.